Thank you, Tim. We now have the added benefit of two short perspectives, really to set discussion going. This is not an event that's designed to just take place here. So we've invited two experts, one academic, one public expert, on these issues to give us short 5-minute reflections, and then we'll open up the discussion to questions from the floor, where we will have two roaming mics. So after the comments, if you like to ask Tim or the other speakers any questions, please do so. We'll have two assistants on the side. Peter.
No, you can stay there.
Oh, stay there.
We're casual.
Of course, it's a pleasure to respond to Tim Lang's stimulating lecture. As his talk tonight has demonstrated, he's a major commentator on contemporary British food policy with what I regard as an all-too-rare ability to use academic research and evidence to inform and critique public policy. Like all good lecturers, we had some sense of what he was going to say in advance, but there were, I've wrote in my notes, a few surprises. There were many surprises, which I've tried to reflect in these comments. Both Will Haskins and I were scribbling as he was writing, so we'll do our best to keep up with his thoughts. Preparing these comments, I was reminded of E.M. Forster's invocation, "Only Connect." He makes that invocation, of course, in Howard's End, a novel where class is central. It's a book, a novel about power, power between individual men and women, power over property, and power to define, a power which we might call authority, a power which you've described in terms of paradigms tonight. Professor Lang calls for reconnection between producers and consumers, and he provided that nice diagram of a triangle, the state, the food supply chain, and civil society. What I want to argue in these brief remarks is that we also need to reconnect between scales, between geographical scales. And I'd argue that powerful agents in the food chain have mastered the ability to connect scales, to jump between scales, literally from the local to the global, and that we, in understanding consumer culture, need to be equally agile. I want to consider a variety of scales from the local to the global. Indeed, I could have gone even smaller to start with. The references to obesity tonight show that food is powerful in relation to our individual corporeality, our bodies. I could talk also about individuals in terms of biography, in terms of the project I'm currently working on life histories within the food commodity chain. So there are a whole variety of scales. For the sake of argument here, I'm going to talk about local, national, and international. This emphasis on geography, on space, will be no news to Professor Lang, editor of a very successful Atlas of Food, and as we saw from his slides tonight, well-versed in the power of maps and of thinking spatially, the hallmarks of my own discipline, geography. First, then, the local scale. When the Competition Commission reported in 2000 on the effects of retail concentration on consumer choice, it concluded there was a high degree of consumer satisfaction with supermarkets in the UK. First sight, undermining what Professor Lang's been arguing. But it found evidence of unsatisfied demand in some localities, and we think immediately about the so-called food deserts. But more importantly, there are unsatisfied demands among other groups of consumers in all kinds of localities. The elderly and non-car owners come to mind immediately. I'd argue that to investigate demand, to investigate deserts, both in the macro sense but in other senses too, that social class is not a simple handle on those issues, not at least class in simple economic terms. We need to move towards a different kind of analysis of household composition, distinguishing wealth from disposable income, for example, and thinking about some of the softer issues that we might refer to in terms of lifestyle. The Competition Commissioners concluded that the retail industry was broadly competitive when they looked at the national scale, but they added significantly, in paragraph 277, whether or not consumers have adequate choice will depend very much on local circumstances, which vary widely from area to area. So at the local scale, it's not hard to demonstrate that geography matters. Moving to the national scale, we could contrast Professor Lang's emphasis on the conflicting interests within the UK food industry, the food wars of his title, with the government's recent attempts to bring these conflicting interests together for the mutual benefit of UK PLC. I'm thinking, for example, of DEFRA's report on working together for the food chain, or the Currie Commission's report on the future of farming, whose key message was about reconnection between the various parts of the UK food chain. Yet, as Tim Lang and others have argued, the government's emphasis on increasing the competitiveness of UK food industry represents a particular version of the national interest. And this evening he's shown us a whole different variety of national interests which are not easily reconcilable with that economic imperative, in the short term at least. Goals such as environmental sustainability, animal welfare, or other social goals such as improving human nutrition or reducing social inequalities. I'd argue, and I think Professor Lang would agree, that these interests are socially constructed, by which I mean they are politically contested. And it's one of the achievements of the British retail industry that they've managed, by and large, to persuade the consuming public that they're acting in their interests. Finally, let's look at the international scale, where it's clear that what we eat is increasingly determined by forces that extend well beyond the UK, whether through the agency of transnational corporations or regulatory bodies such as the EU. What Professor Lang's analysis points to here is the need to make connections between scales, not just between the global north and south, but also among the various players in each of these global regions. The kind of policy solutions he reaches towards the end of his talk, some of them are at the individual scale, but many of them, and those particularly advocated by groups such as Sustain, call for the internalisation within the food industry of a whole range of costs that are currently considered external by the industry, on the polluter pays principle. But if we want the British food industry to absorb the wider costs that are generated by the way it currently does its business, paying for some or all of the costs of excess food miles, the pollution generated by car-borne trips to out-of-town supermarkets, the disposal of packaging and other waste products, or the social costs of obesity and poor nutrition, all of these issues require action at the international scale. They cannot be addressed nationally or locally. My argument then is about the need to think imaginatively about scale, and particularly about the connections between geographical scales. This in turn, I think, calls for a more sophisticated understanding of geography. It's easy to show that most consumers don't know where their food has come from or how it was produced, but often debates about food policy reduce this complexity to the simple metric of distance, as in the familiar debate about food miles. My own work, both in a previous project about transnational connections in the food and fashion sectors, and in my current work on food commodity chains as part of this Cultures of Consumption programme, calls for a more complex understanding of the material and symbolic geographies that are involved in moving food from farm to fork. Our current work, in collaboration with the National Life Story Collection at the British Library, seeks to understand the place of food in people's everyday lives, in its biographical context, and in its wider social and political context, including all the changes that have taken place within living memory. One conclusion of this research, which is still at an early stage, is that distance can be a very misleading measure of the social and environmental costs of food. At the risk of oversimplification, shorter food chains are not inherently better than longer chains. Issues like transparency and regulation are, or ought to be, equally important to consumers in making informed choices about what to buy and what to eat. So my thanks to Tim Lang for a stimulating lecture, and I hope I've reinforced rather than undermined his argument by appealing to geographies of scale and connection.
Thank you, Peter. Chris.
I first heard of Tim Lang about 15 years ago. There was a woman called Edwina Currie, remember her? Who said something about eggs. And the British food industry got up in arms and how she could be saying things like this. And then this sort of figure, who is described to me as a sort of crypto-Marxist figure, started making comments. And the British food industry spent most of its time hunting down this fellow Lang rather than actually dealing with the issue. I think if you look at the comments that Tim was making 15 years ago, again, what the food industry was saying 15 years ago, you know who was right in the perspective 15 years later. And tonight, Tim's been his usual tour de force, one of his better tour de force that I thought. Not all of it that I'd necessarily agree with, but certainly something to keep you awake while it's going on. Now, I do agree with them that diet is A, the biggest issue facing the food industry now, and I do also agree with them that it is an issue which is hugely underestimated, but it is also an issue which I think governments have very, very difficulty with. Governments intervene in our lives through regulation. And they usually intervene to stop us from doing bad things to each other, rather than doing bad things to ourselves. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you take the issue of food safety, where northern foods can do terrible things to you and kill you quite readily, the government feels an obligation to stop northern foods from doing things like that. You can go and count the bugs in the factory, and you can manage them and measure them and regulate them and thereby produce safe food. Not so easy to do when you're in the issue of diet, where you can argue that most of the problems of diet, not all, but a big chunk of the problems of diet, are self-inflicted. In other words, people make assessments about how they eat. And there are no measurements of it like there are with bugs. I mean, about 30, 40 years ago, people were saying that the dietary problems related to carbohydrates. Then they went to fats. Now we've got Atkins. We've got a very confusing position for both consumers, but I hate the word consumers, people to respond to, but also for governments to respond to. There are obviously genetic factors related to diet, which governments certainly can't do very much about in the short term. There are, however, economic and social failures, which are very spectacular, and Tim demonstrated that, which governments can do. It didn't just relate to diet, that relates to a whole agenda of inequality and deprivation in our society. Martin Wolf, a splendidly right-wing economist for the Financial Times, has got a very interesting comment, which I think needs to be brought into the calculation, that the family has been progressively nationalised since about 1855, and that process, despite the privatisation which has gone on in our society the last few years, the nationalisation of the family goes on with aplomb, and people increasingly, all of us, because we're more so useless as parents now, increasingly say it's not our problem, Gov, it's the government's problem. And you've got the situation here with the issue of health. And I remember Virginia Bottomley, when she tried to crack this one, taking responsibility, very worried about half goes of chocolate biscuits, and she got Dominic Cadbury, I'd say his business is still in the frame, very excited about it. I had to referee a battle between these two titans. One saying, well, stop people eating half coated chocolate biscuits. The other saying, if you do that, 20,000 jobs are going to be obliterated in Bourneville. And neither were right, of course, a completely facile argument, which should never have happened in the first instance. However, I do think that there is an issue about children's advertising. And in that respect, this is a branded manufacturer's responsibility as much as a retailer's responsibility. I do think there's an issue, but how do you intervene? The example of smoking over the last 40 years, and smoking, whatever else there is, smoking is absolutely clear-cut link of health, and it's taken governments 40 years to half get the issue under control. Despite gigantic bans on limitations on advertising, the government's record has not been very successful. One of the things governments must observe, and I want to come on to this in a moment, the question of the single interest pressure group, which I think is increasingly a serious problem for government. Single interest pressure groups don't take account of other single interest pressure groups' interests, and therefore you get very distorted approaches. And depends which is the most effective single interest pressure group going at the moment. At the moment, I think the best one is the Royal Society for Protection of Birds, which has got a fantastic source of membership, a fantastic source of money, and is able to make a comment about practically anything that crosses its path. The Royal Society of Protection of Birds, however, has to also remember, in order to keep its membership up, it's always got to say that the birds are on the last legs. There was a fantastic piece of research by them about a fortnight ago, where they had to demonstrate that 100 species of birds, which had seemed to be in decline 30 years ago, that figure was now down to 12. That's pretty bad news for membership. So they just concentrated on the 12 and forgot about the 88. And of course, John Humphreys joined the brigade, and away we were with a huge problem with the remote buzzard, which was going to stop the country eating their cornflakes. Now, you have to be careful about single interest groups, because they can be as self-serving. As a single interest group is a Cadbury, it is also the RSPB, it is also the NFU, it is also the British Retail Consortium. All of these characters are coming at government, and government's always going to be seen to be getting it wrong one place or the other. A word about the supermarkets. The argument seems to be that supermarkets lead consumers to do all sorts of nasty things, do they? Supermarkets, it seems to me, jumped onto the organic bandwagon with aplomb. And when they saw there was a bit of money to be made out of organic, they went for it. Supermarkets very rapidly banned GM foods from their shops before people had a chance to discuss the issue properly, because it appeared to be good. Supermarkets cut prices because people want them. Supermarkets provide convenience because people want them. Supermarkets provide these ranges because people want them. I think supermarkets, the criticism I'd have in supermarkets, is not that they're leading too much, but that they're responding too much, and that they're not taking their rightful role in that situation. I'm nearly finished. The last thing I would say is that whilst I take this idea of diet very seriously, I still don't forget my old friend Malthus, who's been going on getting it wrong for 230 years, and maybe get it wrong for the next 40 years. However, let's get some figures in our mind that the population of the world has got to go up by another 1.5 billion in the next 30 years, and those people, probably being more affluent, are going to be more carnivorous, and therefore the amount of food they're going to need is going to be substantial. Let us say the amount of food to be produced over the next 40 years, I think Tim will know it better than me, something between 30 and 40%. The amount of cultivatable land in the world is going to be extra. I think the figure the World Bank says is 5%. The amount of the world's water engaged in the production of food with farmers is 70%. Now, those are big intangibles. How are we going to get around that? Now, it seems to me that the first one, Jim also mentioned, the first one we should tackle is the issue of waste. My guess is that 70% of the food that is produced in the world is wasted. If we could halve the waste of that food, and that is from farm through storage, huge loss in storage, although the farmers are doing much better. We lose much less food in harvest than we did 30 or 40 years ago. But through manufacturers' waste, through retailers' waste, through catering waste, and above all, through domestic waste in our own country. Now, I still would not dismiss the issue of food supply and the problem of food supply. That's why I do not dismiss genetic modification, because we need to be sure that we're right about food supply before we reject genetic modification altogether.
Thank you very much, Chris.